Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Hosea chapter 9, which I will call The Lord Will Punish Israel, part 1. Hosea is prophesying about the fall of northern Israel, which occurred in 722 when the Assyrians came in and wiped them out. We don't know the exact date. Hosea every now and then prophesied against Judah too in the previous chapters. In this chapter, the only nation that will be aimed at by Hosea will be the northern kingdom of Israel. And by the way, it's not expressly stated in the book of Hosea where he was from, but as Wikipedia says, it's apparent from the level of detail and familiarity focused on the northern geography that Hosea was somewhere in the north when he prophesied. Now, this is an easy chapter, so I'm going to take it very quickly, verse by verse. Hosea says, "Do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultation like the nations, for you have played the harlot, forsaking your God. You have loved harlot's earnings on every threshing floor." Of course, harlotry is the go-to metaphor that God and his prophets used to describe the Israelites' penchant for idolatry. Why would the Jews be said to love harlot's earnings on every threshing floor? Well, of course, the immediate reference is to the fact that the Israelites would take harlots there to the threshing floor and have their way with them. But it might also refer to Israel's placing idols on the threshing floor, one of my commentators suggested. Verse 2, threshing floor and wine press will not feed them. In other words, the vines are going to fail just like the grain crops are going to fail. And that's because of the judgment that God's going to bring on the northern Israelites. Verse 3, they will not remain in the Lord's land. That land really belonged to God, not the Israelites, and so Hosea calls it the Lord's land. And the Israelites are about to get evicted by their landlord. But Ephraim will return to Egypt. Ephraim, of course, is the typical title for northern Israel because Ephraim was the biggest province in northern Israel. But Ephraim will return to Egypt. Now, what does that mean? Well, it could either be a literal return or it could be a symbolic return. Gill says it's a literal return. Some people escaped the siege of Samaria by the Assyrians, that three-year siege before 722 when Samaria finally fell and they went down to Egypt. Now, there's no record of that. This is just an assumption on Gill's part. It's reasonable. Going back to Egypt was predicted in the law in Deuteronomy 28:68, "And the Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships by the way about which I spoke to you. You will never see it again. And there you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer." Now perhaps Moses in Deuteronomy 28 was referring to this. Northern Israelites running from the Assyrians, destitute, and then trying to sell themselves in slavery to the Egyptians. Well, that's one option. The other option is that when Hosea says that Ephraim will return to Egypt, he's speaking symbolically. Egypt standing for bondage, because the Jews were in slavery in Egypt, and so Ephraim will return to bondage. They will return to Egypt, which is bondage. And in Assyria, they will eat unclean food. In other words, they will return to bondage, and their bondage will be in Assyria, in the Assyrian Empire. They were carried out to the Mesopotamian Valley between the Tigris and the Euphrates, and some of them were carried even east of the Tigris in northern present-day Iran, in the land of the Medes, and all of that is slavery and bondage, and Egypt is a symbol of that. I tend to go along with Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown with that view. Although Gill's view is reasonable, it could be some literal escapees down to Egypt. In Assyria, they will eat unclean food. Nothing's kosher in Assyria. Verse 4, they will not pour out libations of wine to the Lord. There's no temple. The temple's in Jerusalem. And the northern Israelites were using their fake temples, their false temples, their golden calf temples in Dan and Bethel. Their sacrifices will not please him, will not please Yahweh. Of course not. Their bread will be like mourner's bread. Now, mourner's bread would be bread that has come perforce in contact with a dead body, because a dead body and everything that was related to it were all polluted. In other words, if you're eating bread in the house of a dead person when they laid the body out for whatever their version of a wake was, well, then that bread is going to be polluted. And so God is saying the ordinary bread of the northern Israelites will be like that polluted bread in a house with a dead body. We read about defiled bread in the law in Deuteronomy 26:14. And this is God talking to a hypothetical Israelite who was commanded by the God to speak properly, I have not eaten of it, the tithe, while mourning, nor have I removed any of it while I was unclean, nor offered any of it to the dead. I have listened to the voice of the Lord my God. So the idea in the law was, if you offered bread to a dead person, like in a house, in a funeral service, that would be a no-no, because that would make you unclean. So the Assyrians will be like mourner's bread. All who eat of it will be defiled, for their bread will be for themselves alone. Now that bread, not the mourner's bread, but the bread that's mentioned at the end of verse 4, is the mincha, the bread offering that was to be offered as a sacrifice for their sins, as one of the Levitical offerings. It will be for themselves alone, for the northern Israelites alone. And that's because the northern Israelites don't have a temple to offer it in. At the end of verse 4, Hosea says, it, this sacrificial bread, will not enter the house of the Lord. That's because the northern Israelites are going to be in Assyria. And even if they were back home, they would be putting the bread into these false temples of the golden calves in Dan and Bethel. We go now to Hosea 9, verses 5 through 8. What will you do on the day of the appointed festival and on the day of the feast of the Lord? Of course, the northern Israelites had set up those three major feasts, Passover, Weeks, and Tabernacle. Passover in the spring, Feast of Weeks in the early summer, Tabernacle in early fall. They were fake copies of the true feast, which were done down in Jerusalem. But Hosea said, what are you going to do on the day of your appointed festival and on the day of the feast? For behold, they will go because of destruction. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Now that doesn't mean that Egypt will gather up the feast. It means that Egypt will gather up the people who are going to the feast. Barnes says that Egypt will gather up the northern Israelites because individual northern Israelites would flee to Egypt to avoid Assyrian invasion, which happened, of course, in the 3 years before 722. And also earlier than that, Tiglath-Pileser III, about 730, came in and took some cities too. At any rate, the fear of the Assyrians would drive Israelites down to Egypt. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Memphis is that prominent city in Egypt, which is right south of where the Great Pyramids are today on the Nile River and the Lower Nile. And the Great Pyramids are just south of present-day Cairo, where On and Heliopolis was. And so Memphis is a well-known place in Egypt. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Weeds will take over their treasures of silver. Now that would be because weeds would grow up around the deserted houses where the silver was kept. But since the Assyrians had deported all the northern Israelites, everything is desolate and the weeds are starting to grow. No more silver. Silver is replaced by weeds. Thorns will be in their tents. Likewise, in their dwelling places, thorns will be growing up. The days of punishment have come. The days of retribution have come. Let Israel know this. The prophet is a fool. Now, that could be the true prophet was considered to be a fool by the evil Israelites, as Gill suggests. Or it could be, it's talking about prophets who are false prophets and they're fools. I prefer that option. That's Clark's view of it, and I think that's probably the truth. The prophet is a fool. The inspired man is demented because of the grossness of your iniquity and because your hostility is so great. Ephraim was a watchman with my God, a prophet. Yet the snare of a birdcatcher is in all his ways. And there is only hostility in the house of his God. Ephraim was a watchman. Hosea likes to contrast the way things were with the way things are now. Ephraim used to be like a prophet, speaking the words of God. Yet the snare of a birdcatcher is in all his ways. Instead of ministering to people, Ephraim is catching people to eat them. And there is only hostility in the house of his God. Notice Ephraim is said to have a God that belongs to him, but it's not the house of Yahweh, not the house of my God, if Yahweh was speaking. And that's because Israel had false golden calf temples. The calf at Bethel is also a calf at Dan. This is Gill, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and Calvin's view. There is only hostility in the house of his God. In other words, hostility towards God. Verse 7, he said all of this foolish prophecy and demented inspiration was because of the grossness of your northern Israel's iniquity and because your northern Israel's hostility is so great that hostility would be toward God. There is only hostility in the house of his God in verse 8. We go now to Hosea 9, verses 9 through 10. They have gone deep in depravity as in the days of Gibeah. Now, Gibeah refers to an atrocity committed there that was very famous. an old man was approached by a man and his concubine to stay in the old man's house. While they were in there having a good time, some homosexual rapist started knocking on the door and says, "We want this guest so we can have sex with this man, this guest." And the old man said, "No, no, no, take the guest concubine, and I'll throw in my virgin daughter, and you can have your way with them, but leave my guest alone." Homosexuality was considered so gross, which of course it is not now because we're so enlightened. So when the old man gave the concubine and his daughter to the rapist, the homosexual rapist, well, they were bisexual, they raped the concubine. The next morning, the concubine is found dead at the threshold trying to get back in the house. So the guest, the husband of this concubine, cut the corpse of his concubine into 12 pieces and sent one piece to each tribe. That was the days of Gibeah, because that happened in Gibeah, which is a town in Benjamin right to the north of Jerusalem. Let me read that for you since we have some time. Judges 19, verses 22 through 30. While they were enjoying themselves, all of a sudden perverted men of the city surrounded the house and beat on the door. They said to the old man who was the owner of the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him." The owner of the house went out and said to them, "No, don't do this evil, my brothers. After all, this man has come into my house. He's a guest." And that was a big deal back then, Eastern hospitality. He would rather sacrifice his virgin daughter than violate the custom of hospitality. That's something that's really hard for us to understand. "Don't do this horrible thing," the old man said. "Here, let me bring out my virgin daughter and the man's concubine now. Use them. Do whatever you want to them, but don't do this horrible thing to this man." He was also upset about the homosexuality as well as the hospitality. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and took her outside to them. They raped her and abused her all night until morning. At daybreak, they let her go. Early that morning, the woman made her way back, and as it was getting light, she collapsed at the doorway of the man's house where her master was. When her master got up in the morning, opened the doors of the house, and went out to leave on his journey, there was the woman, his concubine, collapsed near the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. That's chivalry, isn't it? The old man and the concubine's husband just let the girls go out there and get raped while they sat in their house. It's disgusting. "Get up," he told her. "Let's go." But there was no response. So the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. When he entered his house, he picked up a knife, took hold of his concubine, cut her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and then sent her throughout the territory of Israel. That was so that everybody would know what the Benjamites did down there. Everyone who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or has been seen since the day the Israelites came out of the land of Egypt to this day." In other words, it was an atrocity. Think it over, discuss it, and speak up. So this was well known in Israel. And so Gibeah is used as a metaphor to show how deep in depravity the northern Israelites have gone in verse 9. "He," Yahweh, "will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins." Verse 10, "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness." Now, if you're walking in the wilderness and you see some grapes, they're going to look very, very good to a thirsty traveler. And that's what Israel was like. Again, the comparison of early Israel to what Israel has degenerated into. "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree." That's very delectable too. Ooh, the figs are growing. That's what Israel used to be like. "But they came to Baal Peor and devoted themselves to shame." Now that's referring, of course, to the incident on the plains of Moab on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, where Moses had taken the children of Israel, where Moses died up there on Mount Pisgah. And you will recall the Israelites got seduced by all the Moabites and Midianite women there at that place. And remember Phinehas, who went in and stabbed one of the Israelites, who was a Cosby. I forgot the names of these two. And I always like to speculate that it was done in flagrante delicto. While they were getting it on, he just goes and spears them like a shish kebab. And there were thousands of Israelites killed because of that sin afterwards. We read in Numbers 25:3, "So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor." Peor is just the name of a place in Moab. "So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel." Sure was. And this Baal of Peor used temple prostitutes in worship like a lot of these pagan places did. "And so they devoted themselves to shame, both spiritually and physically. And they became as detestable as that which they loved." The Israelites were just as bad as the idolaters at Baal Peor. We go now to Hosea 9, verses 11 through 14. As for Ephraim, their glory will fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, and no conception. Of course, the glory of Israel was their descendants. Population was a problem back then. The more people you had, the more powerful you are, kind of like the Muslims today. And notice the reverse order, no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. You got to have conception before you have a pregnancy, and you got to have a pregnancy before you have a birth. Well, you're not even, well, Hosea says, you're not even going to get started on that. You're not even going to have a conception. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them until not a man is left. Now, that not a man is left, I assume, would refer to 722 when the Assyrians carried them all off. Barnes says that's not meant to be taken literally, until zero men are left. It's an expression. How can we prove that? Well, verse 17 says they will be wanderers of the northern Israelites among the nations. Let me read that. My God will cast them away because they have not listened to him, and they will be wanderers among the nations. So you see, there were some left. Well, you could say there weren't any left in Israel. There was not a man left in Israel. But I wonder whether that should be taken literally. Surely the Assyrians would have left a few Israelites in northern Israel. And in fact, let me read you from Wikipedia. According to 2 Chronicles chapter 30, there is evidence that at least some people of the northern kingdom of Israel were not exiled. These were invited by King Hezekiah to keep the Passover in a feast at Jerusalem with the Judean population. That's in 2 Chronicles 30. So it's just an expression. He's going to wipe them out, basically. There's another reason why there were going to be some left, because some of the Jews were going to be converted. As Albert Barnes points out, Hosea 2:23 proves this. I will sow her in the land for myself, Yahweh says, and I will have compassion on no compassion, Ruhamah, on Lo Ruhamah, and I will say to not my people, Lo Ami, you are my people, Ami, and he will say, you are my God. So see, some people are going to be saved. That, of course, is probably referring to the New Covenant Israel, the converted Jews, and the Gentiles too, I suppose, when Jesus came. But I don't think the expression is meant to refer to that far in the future. He's talking about the destruction of northern Israel by the Assyrians around 722 B.C., and even then, I don't believe it can be literal, because there were some left in the land. A lot of them, thousands of them, were carried off. And by the way, Hosea has now switched to speaking in Yahweh's voice. He says, yet I, that's Yahweh, will bereave them, I. Yes, woe to them indeed when I depart from them. That's when Yahweh departs. Ephraim, as I have seen, is planted in a pleasant meadow like Tyre. Tyre was planted on a rock on the Mediterranean Sea, strongly situated there. Samaria was on a mountain that was strong and pleasant, but the strength and beauty of those cities would not save them from destruction. But Ephraim will bring out his children for slaughter. Give them, O Lord, what will you give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breast. Again, the idea that descendants are everything for those ancient people, especially for the Israelites. A miscarrying womb and dry breast means no descendants. Israel will be gone. We go now to Hosea 9, verses 15 through 17. All their evil is at Gilgal. Yahweh is still speaking. Indeed, I came to hate them there because of the wickedness of their deeds. Why is all of the northern Israelites evil at Gilgal? Well, Gilgal was famous for big events. The covenant of circumcision was renewed there in Joshua's time. The first Passover was kept in the land of Canaan at Gilgal. The people of Israel ate the first fruits of the land at Gilgal. The tabernacle was set up there for a while, and sacrifices were offered up to the Lord. But now, all their evil is there at Gilgal. Things were otherwise than before. All manner of iniquity was committed in Gilgal, especially idolatry. Gilgal was chosen by idolaters because it had formerly been famous for religious worship. And so, the idols went there. Again, a contrast between the way things used to be and the way the things had degenerated into. Indeed, I came to hate them there, Yahweh says. He hates the northern Israelites at Gilgal. Because of the wickedness of their deeds, I will drive them out of my house. Now, one might ask, what is God's house? Well, Benson says what this means is that Yahweh will no longer consider the northern Israelites as his family, as his children, as his servants, because that's what's in a household, family, children, and servants. And so, the Israelites will be driven out to become wanderers. In fact, well, let me read till I get there. Yahweh says, I will love them no more. All their princes are rebels. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They will bear no fruit, like a dried up peach tree. Even though they bear children, I will slay the precious ones of their womb. He's already said there wouldn't be any children. But of course, this is poetic. It's not to be meant to be taken like some kind of a sociology report. He's already said no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. But then he says, well, even if they might bear some children, they're going to get killed because I'm going to kill them. I will slay the precious ones of their womb. My God will cast them away because they have not listened to him. Now, if you think that God is being mean here, remember, these people were horrible sinners. And horrible sin results in condign, horrible punishment. That's, of course, something this age does not understand. Oh, see you on the other side. As if they get a free ticket to heaven just by being a good person. No matter how many people they've fornicated with, no matter how many people they've lied to, no matter how many people they've disappointed, let down, failed, as we all have. But no, it doesn't matter. God's understanding. He's a loving God. Well, no, he's very loving and merciful, but if you keep on sinning, you're going to get results such as the northern Israelites got. My God will cast them away because they have not listened to him. And that's exactly what's going to happen to individuals who do not listen to God. They will be wanderers among the nations. Ah, the so-called 10 lost tribes. These Assyrian exiles after 722, they've got a title now, capital T, capital L, capital T, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. I remember even before I understand any of the Old Testament, I heard about the 10 lost tribes, and I was fascinated by them. I said, well, what happened to them? Well, this is what happened to them. They became wanderers among the nations. Some of them may have come back to Jerusalem when the southern Judahite exiles came back in 538 or so. But generally, they've been lost to history. Why? Because they have not listened to Yahweh. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Hosea chapter 9. We're prepared to go on our next audio to Hosea chapter 10, which I will call The Lord Will Punish Northern Israel, Part 2. And so the denunciations will continue. I hope you continue listening to said denunciations in the next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.